Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome to the Today's You podcast. It is finally March, which means we have tons of college basketball coming your way. Everything in terms of the bubble, the tournament, the seeds, we're going to cover it all. Also going to have plenty of college football talk as well. Let's go ahead and get started, though, on the hard court. Get our first caller on. Hey, Bobby, how's it going?
Hey, Colin, good. How are you?
Doing pretty well. I watched as much of the Kentucky game as I could last night, and then I had to step away and get some free pancakes from IHOP, so I actually missed the end of the game. That's how much faith I had in the Wildcats. I grew up a Georgia Tech fan, so I just knew the Bulldogs would lose it down the stretch, and sure enough, they did. But on that game, I know you're a big Kentucky fan. Do you feel better about Kentucky after that game, seeing as they rose up in a really tough environment? I was impressed by the environment at Stegman Coliseum there for Georgia, traditionally a football school, but that place was rocking. Do you feel better about Kentucky moving forward now that they stepped up to the plate, or is a win like that, a narrow win like that, a concern for you going forward?
It's neither. If you want to say you feel better about Kentucky, sure, but it's a road game, you know, on senior night against an NCAA tournament team. I expected it to be close, obviously not falling down by 9 in the second half. That was unexpected. And if you want to say, you know, where do you feel good about, there's certain points, like you said, coming back, you know, kind of, hey, we're down 9, like you said, hostile environment. You could tell watching it on your couch how hostile it was. And to still get the win shows a lot. As well as, you know, the play of Andrew Harrison over the last month to 2 months now. I mean, that's what continues to be a pleasant sight, and obviously Karl Anthony Towns. It was a little bit expected, I guess. I expected a close game. Not falling down 9. So if you want to feel good, that's where it is. But I don't think there should be any reason for concern or anything like that.
Okay. Interesting. There were plenty of people last night on Twitter. They even brought it up during the game saying that, you know, a loss might be good for Kentucky. I know you're definitely against that. We'll get Bev on the line here for a not so big of a Kentucky fan perspective. How's it going?
Hey, doing well, man. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah. Yep. So just talking, Bobby and I, about how you could really look at it two ways. One way, the Kentucky-Georgia game, that is, Kentucky stepped up in a hostile environment. Another way is that they really struggled for a good bit of the game there. Did you take away more from that game about Kentucky or from Georgia playing that well against the number one team in the nation?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, Georgia played a great game. I think they had a great game plan, without a doubt. And you know, the atmosphere for a Georgia basketball game was absolutely crazy to me. I never imagined it would get that raucous at a Georgia basketball game. So I mean, Kentucky also had that going against them. I will say, and I don't know if y'all have already talked about this. I mean, I was very, very shocked to see that, Georgia won the rebounding battle, which I never thought would happen in a million years. Kentucky got kind of beat up a little throughout most of the game. And some that I don't think a lot of people are talking about is that, you know, with the lead down the stretch, I mean, Georgia missed their final 5 free throws, including 3 1-and-1s that would have given them, I want to say 2 of them would have given them a bigger lead. I may be wrong. And if I am, you can correct me. But, I mean, you know, I mean, and part of that, you know, you can say Georgia choked it away. I don't think it's that. I think they were just completely worn out by the physical nature of the game. You know, and you know, I mean, the teams are going to have games like that. I mean, Kentucky has shown, you know, in other games that sometimes they're not quite as dominant as we expect, and I think that happened last night. I think Kentucky, you know, also showed that they have a couple really, really reliable players. I mean, Karl Anthony Towns is just unbelievable. I know I've talked to you all about this before. I actually think he should be the number one pick and not Jahlil Okafor. I know that's not the most popular statement around.
Bobby had an article.
And then Harrison
that.
Played really, really well.
Yeah. I mean, this has got to be almost a month ago now. Bobby had a great article on Today's U saying that Karl Anthony Towns should definitely be considered as a possible number one draft pick. But I think, Bev, that's the most positive I've heard you be about Kentucky on the podcast.
Yeah, I mean,
seems like you might be around a bit.
Yeah, I mean, Kentucky, you know, didn't look as dominant as they usually do. I mean, maybe they're not quite as dominant as we think they are, but that doesn't change the fact they're the best team. It doesn't change the fact that they played well down the stretch after struggling a lot in the second half. They played well. I mean,
yeah, yeah. And,
you know, I mean, it's not like Georgia is some, you know, pushover team. I mean, they're a good team. So,
right. I think Georgia will be playing in March in the NCAA tournament. They're probably on the right side of the Bible and or of the bubble, not the Bible. They're in the Bible.
The Bible.
They are there.
Sure.
On the right side, another big bubble game last night was Iowa, Indiana. I was pulling for Indiana because you guys both know I've been high on Indiana for a good bit of the season. I will give you that their defense is bad, but I do think that if they can get into the tournament, they can make noise there. I could be completely crazy. Maybe I'm – Bob, you've said that I put way too much faith in Tom Crean. But do you guys think now, especially with that loss to Iowa, is Indiana a team that gets into the tournament that even has that opportunity? Bobby, I'll go with you first. I know that you like some players, but not necessarily the way Tom Crean coaches that team.
Yeah, Tom Crean, you know, I say Rick Barnes is the worst coach in America. Tom Crean, not far behind. Him, Herb Sendek, and Rick Barnes should really hang out, you know, all the time and just exchange terrible coaching ideas because Tom Crean is ruining Indiana. You know, they're celebrating Sweet 16s, and he's been there long enough now where that shouldn't be the standard, or cut down the nets when you go there once. But I mean, they'll probably sneak in. I don't think they should, but they will because they're going to win. I think they get to that one more win that they need to, whether it's I forget who they close with or you know when they open up the Big Ten tournament. They're going to be either in the playing game in Dayton or they're going to be an 11 or 12 seed, and they're not going to win a game. I mean, could they get hot? Sure, but they're not playing at Assembly Hall. You know, I do like Yogi Ferrell and James Blackman and Troy Williams, but, I mean, yeah, they're decent players, but there's not enough to do anything there. Even if they get hot, they can't play a lick of defense or they're going to get killed inside. I mean, yeah, you can – Well, you can't even say you did it against Northwestern because you lose by, you know, you're down double digits, you end up cutting it to seventh and lose to Northwestern. So Indiana, it's a name on the front of the jersey that should scare people, but they shouldn't.
I can definitely see the argument. I think that Iowa is kind of the opposite from Indiana in that they really don't have those big name players that you see, you know, on all the highlights. They don't get on ESPN all the time like Indiana seems to do. Like you said, based on that name. Bev, do you think is Iowa a team that people should be more scared about? They've gone, I mean, not just under the radar because it's not like they're a ranked team, but nobody has said a word about Iowa basically all year. Do you think Iowa should get a little more respect, especially since they are right now at least seem to be heading towards the tournament?
You know, I think so. I mean, they play in the Big Ten, which, I mean, is – I mean, Big Ten is good.
I mean, this year.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's historically good. The only teams that I really think are any good in the Big Ten this year are, you know, are Wisconsin. I think Maryland's pretty good. And I think and Ohio State's kind of inconsistent, but I like them. I like Iowa, but I like Iowa mainly because nobody has been talking about them. And if you look at their record, they really have only one bad loss, and it was in overtime at Northwestern. Yeah. I mean, if I want to say it's their only bad loss. I just pulled up their schedule. I mean, their other, I mean, I guess their second bad loss would be at home against Minnesota by 5, which isn't a bad loss at all. So,
to a non-tournament team.
Yeah.
That's a terrible loss.
That is not terrible. I mean, it was at home, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At home to a team.
I wouldn't say a
5 point. That's pretty bad.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, a team with like a 17-12, a loss to a team with 17-12 record at home. I mean, a lot of teams have that game. Wisconsin lost to Rutgers. I know Kaminsky wasn't playing, but, you know, at the same time. So I guess, you know, those are their two bad losses. They've been playing well recently. I mean, they've won 5 straight. Do I think they're going to do much in the tournament? No. I mean, I think they'll play a team or two well in the tournament, but, I mean, I don't see them doing anything special.
Yeah.
Yeah, they seems like the Big Ten has a lot of they could get a lot of teams in the tournament. I wonder how the Big Ten is going to fare once they're in the dance. I mean, I do like Indiana if they make it, but that's just me, you know, the one team I'm kind of putting my hat on that nobody else is. We'll get to the top part of the bracket again, though. I mean, the one seed you have seem to be cementing themselves. But then you also have Kansas, which right now is sort of seen as a 2 seed by most. They wrap up another Big 12 title. Everybody doubted them this year. I did as well. But they just keep winning games. Is Kansas, Bobby, do you think they are a legitimate national title threat, or is this a team that had some inconsistencies this year that are going to catch up to them when they are playing tournament basketball?
Well, a couple things. First, I think your statement about one seed cementing themselves is false. There's only one team that cemented themselves as a one seed, and that's Kentucky.
Yeah.
Duke and Virginia are still going to lose at least one more game. What, you know, whoever wins the ACC championship, one of the two teams is going to have a loss. They'll fall out. Villanova, I mean, they showed vulnerable last night against Creighton. I think they'll end up winning out, but they could lose. You got Arizona. I mean, there's still a lot of moving parts when it comes to the one seed. But in terms of Kansas, are they a national title contender? I mean, to me, it's Kentucky and then everybody else, as we've all kind of said. When you get to the other everybody else, Kansas is in that, I want to say, maybe not the first bunch, but the second bunch. It wouldn't surprise me if they're in a Final Four or even a championship game. Would I take them against Kentucky? No. I don't think it'll be obviously as bad as the game in Indianapolis earlier this year. They are who they are, and that's not changing. Self still preaches defense. The one difference is this year is he's playing more through his guards. Frank Mason kind of came out of a little bit of nowhere to have a breakout season. Kelly Oubre has been living up to the hype that I always said that he should be the focus of this team. Perry Ellis is still playing old man basketball. So it's
and looking like it, too.
So it's
Hairline's struggling.
I mean they're going to be the they're in that second tier of good teams after Kentucky. So, yeah, what national title contender, sure, if you're taking Kentucky out. Final Four contender,
right.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, it makes you question, I mean, Kansas winning another Big 12 title. This year, we've talked on the podcast before, is the Big 12 overrated? Bev, I know it takes a lot to – Kansas definitely deserves a lot of credit for the Big 12 title. But do you think, especially the past few years, that the Big 12 has gotten a little bit too much respect? And is this year more about that there wasn't really another great team, so Kansas won the Big 12? Or is this Kansas team just that much better than these other teams in the Big 12 for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years? I mean, they've won it, was it 11 times in a row now?
Yeah,
but
11
times. Is the Big 12 getting too much respect outside of Kansas?
Yes, I think.
Oh.
I know that's hard to say. You know, because the other teams in there, every single time I'm high on them, they screw up. Like, they let me down. I mean, Iowa State, as we talked about, doesn't play defense. So, I mean, and unless they're just lights out in the tournament, I don't see them making a really deep run. I mean, and by really deep, I mean, like, Final Four deep. I mean, I think they can make the Sweet 16. And Oklahoma, God, man, I don't know about Oklahoma. You know, funny enough, West Virginia is kind of the other team, I think, that can make some noise. West Virginia and Baylor.
Baylor is going to make the Final Four. If they're not in Kentucky's bracket, if Baylor is not in Kentucky's bracket, they're going to make the Final Four. I see them as a four seed, probably beating any number one seed. Because they're, according to KenPom, I was looking today on it actually. According to KenPom, they rank 6th in the nation in terms of three-point defense. And they're clearly the number one offensive rebounding team in the country. They just defend the hell out of you and then just go grab every rebound. And they're deep. They play 7 guys over 17 minutes.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Sean Oakman just, you know, changed the name on the back of the jersey, got a basketball jersey, and showed up as Rico Gathers. Yeah, they're really the same person, actually.
Yeah. Rico Gathers is phenomenal. He's one of my favorite players all of college basketball.
Going back to Baylor, who are you going to stop on their team? I mean, their leading scorer comes off the bench in Torian Prince. And like we said, you got Rico Gathers. You still have Kenny Cherry running around out there. I mean,
and he's good.
They have a ton of options. If they're a four seed, I'm scared as a number. If they're not in Kentucky's bracket, I like them in the Final Four.
Definitely can't wait to see both of your brackets.
I could definitely see that happening. I've always liked Baylor anyway. They always seem to get players that I just love to watch, so I'm kind of biased. I mean, in the overall Big 12, funny enough, I actually see a team like Baylor or West Virginia potentially going further than Kansas. Kansas just hasn't really impressed me this year. I know it sounds crazy because, you know, they won another Big 12. They're like 24-6 or something.
Take the Kentucky game out of your mind. Is the narrative different about Kansas? Is the question.
They did lose to Temple by like 25.
Yeah, but that's again one of those weird games. You know, about a week before Christmas, and you're playing, you know, in Philly on like a Tuesday night or Monday night. Take the Kentucky game out, and I think the narrative about Kansas is different because they don't have that ugly loss. I mean, you have the loss to Temple. But Temple's fighting for a tournament spot. It's the same thing with, Arizona. You know, people aren't really knocking Arizona, even though their 3 losses are terrible.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
That's very true. And I also kind of base that off of, you know, last night. I mean, they had to come back and beat a West Virginia team in overtime that didn't have – their 2 best players on the floor. like, and it was at home, and they had to come back. I mean, you know, I mean, a lot of people are saying that's such a gutsy win from Kansas last night. You know, what a great game. And I'm like, I wasn't impressed at all. Like, they beat a team that they're more talented than already, and they beat that less talented team with and that team didn't have, like, the two best players on their team. I worded that horribly. I'm sorry. But y'all know what I'm saying. I apologize.
You're good. The basic premise is that Kansas just feels like sort of a volatile team, if you will, where if they figure it out, they can be great and they could make a Final Four, contend for a championship. But, you know, you can also see them getting upset pretty early. But let's get to some of the games tonight on the docket. Of course, this time of year, lots of bubble teams playing. We have UCLA playing USC. You have Oregon, Miami, LSU also playing. Bobby, in your mind, who needs a win the most right now in terms of the bubble teams? Who has the most to gain with a win?
Well, the easy answer is all of them. But I think LSU and Oregon are on the right side of the bubble. I don't think they have too much to worry about. I think a win just helps them bump up a seed line or maybe moves from, like, you know, the fourth number nine seed up to the first number nine seed or something like that.
Right.
But it's Miami. I mean, Miami's playing without they're playing without McClellan and Rodriguez tonight at Pittsburgh. So how they win that game, I don't know. But we've seen weird things in college basketball. UCLA, I think Miami needs that win more because I think they have less of a shot to make a run in the ACC tournament as UCLA does in the Pac-12 tournament. But it's not unfathomable to think that UCLA, you know, catches Utah or Arizona on an off night and they make the Pac-12 championship game. Hey, now they're going to be on the right side of the bubble.
Right. That's a good point. No. You know, the ACC tournament will probably be a tougher draw. I mean, just based
right.
on the...
Right, you're looking at... Miami's going to have to win a game against either, and you list them, between Virginia, Carolina, Duke, Notre Dame. I mean, there's four teams right there, though. They're going to have to get one of those wins over just to make it into the, you know, conference semis, most likely?
Yeah.
Yeah. Bev, any teams we haven't mentioned that you think really need a win? Or I guess all of them need a win, as Bobby said. But is there anybody on the outside that needs to win in order to get over the bubble hump, I guess?
You mean teams like outside of here?
That are, you know, like a UCLA or Miami, probably right outside of it right now. That could benefit the most with a win, I guess.
Let me think. Where does Davidson stand right now in the whole overall?
Lenardi has them as the very first team out as of today.
Okay. I mean, I think they need to win. I like Davidson. I mean, I've said in a previous podcast, I like Davidson. I think they could surprise a team or two in the tournament. I also think, what's it called? I mean, I did a pretty hot take yesterday, kind of a funny article, about UConn. And obviously they need to win because they're out right now.
They need to win.
And they need to win their conference tournament. I also just said that as a shameless plug to read my article on that because they're not going to do anything in the tournament. But I hope they do. So my article can be kind of funny but not funny. I don't know. The first team I think about is Davidson. And then I think, you know, UCLA needs to win some games down the stretch because UCLA doesn't make any sense to me. I don't really understand that team. Sorry for rambling on and saying basically nothing.
Yeah, the tough to figure out pool with Texas and Indiana. This week,
yeah,
the mid-major conference tournament starting. A lot of good storylines there. I was pretty disappointed with the Wichita State Northern Iowa game. Was really hoping that would be a pretty epic mid-major clash. Bobby, what storylines are you looking forward to the most from the mid-major conference tournament?
I talked about it yesterday. I'm most excited for the Atlantic 10.
Yeah.
There's what I say. There's six teams within four games of first place, or something like that, as of yesterday. And you have only really two locks from the A-10 making the tournament in Dayton and VCU. Well, what happens if they both lose, and let's say the finals is, you know, a UMass versus Davidson? Could you get three or four teams in? I mean, they got six in last year.
Yeah.
You know, the Atlantic 10 is still a mid-major in my book. If you look at the teams, there's not really that true powerhouse. It's a mid-major conference to me. That's the one I'm most looking forward to because there's so many even teams in there, and there's a lot of fun teams to watch, with Dayton being my personal favorite. Outside of that, I mean, there's not a mid-major where you're worried about I guess maybe the Horizon League is the only league where you worry about a team like Green Bay or Valparaiso, if that becomes a two-bid league instead of a one-bid league,
right.
Which would be interesting when it comes to Selection Sunday. And Kiefer Sykes is a hell of a player for Green Bay, who's just a ton of fun to watch. If you haven't seen him yet, just go look at his stats. They're ridiculous. But those are the only two mid-majors. I mean, the rest are pretty much going to be one-bid leagues.
Yeah. I think, and you could even – this isn't going to happen, but you could even make the case for a team like Rhode Island that, you know, is already over 20 wins.
Yeah.
And they have some good teams in the A-10. So I like the A-10 tournament storylines there. Bev, I know you're a big West Coast Conference fan,
yeah.
Zags fan. Are you looking there, or is there another tournament you're looking forward to?
Well, you know, had BYU lost to Gonzaga the other night, I would have, you know, probably said that the West Coast Conference was without a doubt the mid-major tournament I was looking forward to the most. Because BYU is basically in now, unless they lose to like Pacific or something, or like Pepperdine again, because they've already lost to them twice. I think they're going to make a deep run in the West Coast tourney, and I think they'll be fine to make it. Still think Gonzaga wins the tournament because they're Gonzaga. But, yeah, I mean, I'm with Bobby. I mean, the Atlantic 10, to me, is probably the most interesting league in college basketball because it's like you look at the top of that league, and you're like, I mean, and everybody knows, you know, VCU has been ranked most of the year. And they're in like fourth or fifth place right now in the conference.
They're in like third place, a game behind or something like that.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Because I know Dayton is leading right now, right?
Yeah, Dayton, because they beat Rhode Island yesterday.
I'm totally with Bobby. I'm gonna be watching every game in that tournament. Because I think it's an underrated tournament. I mean, an underrated conference. And I don't think they're elite, but I think there are a lot of good teams in there. I mean, I even think like Richmond is a decent team.
Yeah. They could make some noise in the A-10 tournament. Maybe probably not NCAA tournament, but the A-10 tournament.
Yeah. For sure. Oh yeah. Not NCAA tournament, but. But, yeah, I see, you know.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, the only thing I was going to say is that, like, I mean, Dayton and VCU are the front runners win. But I wouldn't be surprised if Davidson or Rhode Island or even UMass wins it. I know that may sound weird, but sorry, I'll stop.
I mean, there's a lot of options there. I'll definitely be watching most of the A-10 tournament, mostly because I want to watch Archie Miller lose and wish he had gone to Wake Forest. But that's just me personally. So maybe
Dayton. Hey, I'm okay with Danny. I'm okay with Danny. Go Deeks. Beat Duke.
Danny Manning is fine too. All right, thanks guys for joining the podcast today. You can read both Bobby and Bev multiple times a week on Today's You and find them on Twitter. Bobby is at UKLefty22 and Bev is at Andrew_Bev. Thanks guys. Have a good one.
All right, thanks.
See ya.
All right, let's get going on some college football talk here. March is big, not just for college basketball, but also college football because it means the start of spring practice. So we'll get our first caller on here. Hey, Ryan, how's it going? Or Dustin, sorry. Dustin, you there?
Oh. Hey, Colin, how are you?
Hey, sorry. Every time I think I have your numbers figured out, I always flip them in my head. That's my bad.
Yeah. Hey, I'm mysterious.
Yeah, okay. Hey, Ryan, how's it going?
Good. How you doing tonight, Colin?
Doing pretty well. Yeah, we have spring practice starting, which means everybody's undefeated. Everybody's excited about the season. And it gets about a month of stuff to talk about, and then we have to go through the brutal summer of waiting for football. Biggest thing that goes on spring practice is probably the position battles. I'll start with you, Ryan. We have some pretty big programs that are going to be looking for new starting quarterbacks next year. Ohio State, it's not going to be a new quarterback, but there's going to be a battle there with those three, two who are Heisman candidates, one who won a national championship. But not just Ohio State. You have Notre Dame with Malik Zaire, Everett Golson. You have FSU trying to replace Winston. Georgia looks like a really complete team if they can get a solid option at quarterback. Ryan, which position battles are you looking forward to the most and going to be keeping the closest eye on in terms of the QB battles?
I think that Notre Dame quarterback position battle is particularly interesting. It's really kind of a race against time. If nothing's sorted out over the course of this spring between Malik Zaire and Everett Golson, Golson could potentially graduate at the end of this semester. And if he were to graduate at the end of this semester and it looked like Malik Zaire was going to be the starting quarterback come next fall, he would then have the option to explore the transfer opportunities that come to grad students there. So, it's a race against time right now to see the way this shakes out this spring. If there's any sort of finality to it by the end of this year, you could see Everett Golson transfer elsewhere. If this is a battle that continues on into the fall, it's going to be kind of up to Everett Golson to decide between battle for a position there or if he wants to go elsewhere and pursue opportunities for immediate playing time at another school. So the one that I'm the most interested with this spring.
Yeah, I definitely think they set themselves up for a pretty interesting battle by starting Malik Zaire in the bowl game. I mean, that's a pretty overt, you know, this job is now available. Dustin, are you looking at Notre Dame as well? I know you're in Big Ten country now. I know Notre Dame isn't the Big Ten, but that's got to be a big talk in the Midwest. Are you looking at Notre Dame or somewhere else in terms of the quarterback position?
Yeah, I am looking at Notre Dame, and I think it's interesting that after one game, Zaire is getting so much attention. And that kind of leads into who I'm really going to be focusing on here over spring practice, and that's going to be Oklahoma. With Trevor Knight and having a mediocre year with the Sooners, that Sugar Bowl performance is now in the rearview mirror, and people in Oklahoma were really upset and disappointed in the way he performed. And now Oklahoma's got a transfer student in Baker Mayfield who, when he was at Texas Tech, threw 13 touchdown passes, only 9 interceptions, and then threw for over 2,000 yards and was named Freshman of the Year down at Texas Tech. So I think that's kind of an interesting little lead-in there that you got Notre Dame who's talking about Malik Zaire, who played really well in one game and now is challenging for that starting quarterback position. I'd say Brian Kelly, you don't want to base it off of one. Obviously, they're going to look at the spring practice, but one game against an LSU team, yeah, it was a good performance, but you know, it doesn't lead into the next season, and it doesn't mean he's going to be successful the next season, as we saw with Oklahoma and Trevor Knight. A lot of expectations, been led to a lot of disappointment. So I think Oklahoma really has the interesting factor there. Do you go with Trevor Knight, a kid who's shown he's got some potential, or do you go with the younger guy, Baker Mayfield, who's also proven he can compete in the Big 12?
Yeah, I mean, these are really good problems to have. You think there's a lot of teams out there that would like to have this decision to make, this battle going on between guys like Trevor Knight and Baker Mayfield, guys who have had success in the past. I really want to start the talk in the college football world about the Katy Perry curse, because after Katy Perry basically called him out and said to call her, Trevor Knight really struggled the rest of the year. So if she goes back on game dates, do not mention anyone of, you know, the Wake Forest football players, not that they would be talking about Wake Forest. But
in Trevor Knight's defense, I'd be nervous too.
Yeah, very true. So we've talked a lot about on these podcasts some running backs in the SEC. It really looks like the SEC is going to be kind of running back central, kind of like the Big Ten was. And I wanted to start a segment here where we talk about some of the best returning running backs, quarterbacks, wide receivers in each conference. We'll sort of finish out the SEC today and then move into the other conferences in these next weeks and cover some wide receivers and quarterbacks. Dustin, in terms of the SEC, who do you think are the best position players outside of running back in 2015 that are going to be challenging for those end-of-the-year awards in 2015?
Well, I really like, and I know I've talked about him quite a bit, from Arkansas, Brandon Allen. He started more games than any other quarterback in the SEC. He started 25 games, and he had a pretty strong season the season ago. He just threw 5 interceptions with 20 touchdown passes. He's gotten better in every statistical category from 2013 to 2014, and he's got a lot of weapons around him. I mean, he's got Alex Collins the other running back just slipped my mind. Jonathan Williams, I think, now off the top of my head, in the backfield, so that's going to provide a lot of weapons. And then he's got Keon Hatcher coming back at wide receiver, and he's got Dominique Reed coming out with a speed receiver. So he's got a lot of weapons. I think he may not be the most talented at that position, but I think he's going to be the one that flourishes the most, and he's going to have them get the most out of his weapons. And then for the wide receiver, one of the guys that I really like is Duke Williams out of Auburn. He's a top target. He's got 730 yards, 5 touchdowns, and he's going to really have the focus of whoever's going to play quarterback at Auburn without Sammy Coates there.
Yeah, I definitely think Arkansas, we've talked about them a good bit on these podcasts, and that could be a scary team next year. They have talent returning everywhere. They had so many close losses this past year. If they start getting some of those close wins in the SEC, watch out. Dustin, who do you like at wide receiver? There's actually, when I sort of decided to do this topic, I took a look at some of the SEC wide receivers. There's some really good options out there, and yet the SEC doesn't often get talked about as, you know, having depth in terms of playmakers on the outside. Do you have any other SEC wide receivers that we should be looking out for?
Well, I'd go Farrell Cooper there from South Carolina. I know he's the top returner in the SEC, and he's going to be really the lone threat for South Carolina, at least heading into spring practice until they are able to develop somebody else. And then Maquan Treadwell, who got hurt from Ole Miss, I really think he's going to be a threat this year if he recovers and he has a healthy recovery. I think he can be a real threat for the Rebels. But again, the one thing that's kind of the deciding factor here may be who the quarterback is, because all three of those teams don't really have a quarterback heading into spring practice. So it's kind of interesting. You know, we lead into this quarterback battle, and some of the top receivers, at least I have on my list, at the quarterback position don't have that established yet. So it may be dependent on who's their quarterback and who can get them the football the most in 2015.
Yeah, I mean, I don't try to do this, but every podcast so far, I think I've found a way to bring up Reggie Ball. And I will make the point that Calvin Johnson was catching balls from Reggie Ball. So it can be done if you don't have quarterback. It can be done. But on that South Carolina note, Ryan, you had a great article today that was on South Carolina and sort of the longevity of Steve Spurrier. He has a Twitter account now, which seems like it could be really dangerous. I'm sure South Carolina is all over that. Do you think Steve Spurrier is the guy who can lead South Carolina back to national prominence, or is this kind of one of those deals where they'll let him stay as long as he wants because he can recruit great talent and sort of keep them relevant even if it's not prominent, if that makes sense?
Well, this isn't a new conversation for Steve Spurrier. Basically, during the entirety of his tenure at South Carolina, there's been some question or another in regards to how interested he is in, continuing to coach and how much longer he'll be there. Ever since that Redskins experiment and he came to South Carolina, there's been a lot of negative recruiting done throughout the SEC of folks saying, that he's only going to be here for 3 or 4 more years. Now, you flash forward 11 years later, and, he's taken that program to unprecedented heights. So he's already established himself at South Carolina. There's not a lot that people are going to be able to do in terms of forcing him out at this point, considering he took that program to 3 straight 11-win seasons before, a disappointing 7-6 year last season. But I do think anytime that you reach 69 years of age and you start to approach 70, there's going to be increased questioning of how much longer he's going to be around. Now, his son, Steve Spurrier Jr., is on that staff. He's done quite a bit in terms of kind of delegating over the course of the last couple of years and giving away some of the responsibilities that he would traditionally have held in his younger days. But, I mean, even his son is quoted as saying that he still thinks that his dad's probably interested in coaching for 5, 6, 7 more years. And, I mean, it's not like it's unprecedented for coaches to continue to be successful into their 70s. If you look at Bill Snyder and what he's doing at Kansas State right now at 75 years old, he's going to be 76 this coming fall and still getting it done for the Wildcats in Manhattan, Kansas. Steve Spurrier certainly can still do it. Now, I think him joining Twitter is a bit of a white flag for him in terms of he's got to show people that he's a little bit more willing to change, kind of embrace the digital mediums that have become so critical, not just in terms of reaching out to a fan base, but they're recruiting tools now at this point. You can use direct messages and even just tweets in general to kind of cast yourself in the best possible light and maintain an open contact routes with these recruits. So I don't know exactly how much tweeting Steve Spurrier is going to be doing on his own behalf. I think we'll see his sports information directors probably handle the vast majority of that responsibility. But the fact that he even allowed people to put his name on that kind of signify that he's willing to change a little bit here in an effort to make these next few years of his career a proper send-off.
Yeah, you can definitely tell he clearly wants to get back there. And some of his press conferences after losses, I mean, they weren't just funny. They were sincere, and he was pretty pissed off multiple times this year. So he definitely has the drive to get back there. Dustin, on that note, you had a great article today on sort of the SEC's reign over the last decade and really kind of looking back on it. They haven't won the national title the last 2 years now after having 7 in a row. Do you think one of the points you made was that a lot of it is sort of based on the great coaches that they've had? And Steve Spurrier was one of those great coaches, but he didn't really contribute to the 7 national titles. Do you think he can get South Carolina back to one of those SEC coaches that is competing for a national title year in and year out? Or is there sort of a ceiling at South Carolina for him? Not just at South Carolina, but is that ceiling sort of lower for the SEC than it was for this past decade?
Well, I think we talked about it last time. I think Ryan mentioned that in order for some of these other teams to improve, like the Tennessees and the Arkansas, some of these other teams are going to have to take a step backwards or they're going to have to up their recruiting game. And the way Alabama and LSU, they just haven't been as dominant in recent years. So I think with Steve Spurrier, I'll take him as my head coach any day of the week to get me to the double-digit win mark. And then, recent years when they had those 11-2 seasons, had kind of that one, again, I'm going to use this because I think we bring it up in every podcast, that term Clemsoning. I feel like they have one of those games every season. They have just a major letdown game that they should win, and either it's early in the season or it's late in the year. They take care of business other than that. If somehow they can get over that hump and that mental state that, they can't win the big one or they can't complete a full season, I think they could be a national contender. But playing in the SEC, playing against that tough competition year in, year out, it's easier said than done to get over that hump and try to get to that breaking point where you're competing for SEC championships and now for the college football playoffs. Can he do it? Yeah. Will he do it? I don't know. I think if he's going to be around next year, he'll have plenty of opportunities. I don't know if he'll be able to do it next year in his next 3 years, but we'll see what happens. I think there's still the possibility there. He's still a great coach. He took a team that had only four or five winning seasons in the previous 14, 15 years prior to him arriving, and now he's taking this team to almost the pinnacle. So it'll be interesting to see what he can do if he chooses to stay there a little bit longer.
Yeah, maybe instead of Clemsoning, we should call it something like Palmettoing, something that would include South Carolina and Clemson in the Palmetto State there. You can't call it South Carolina.
There you go.
And not Clemson. We'll figure out some good term for it until Clemson or South Carolina can buck that trend. We'll figure it out one of these days. So we've talked a good bit, and really the whole sports media world has talked about how moving forward the SEC is probably still a great football conference. They might not win national championships every year, but they're still a deep conference. The other side of it, though, is that, as Dustin pointed out, the past decade, we really haven't seen from a conference before. Ryan, do you think, or I guess the better question is, where does the SEC this last decade stack up against some of the other college sports streaks, like UCLA winning those national titles or another conference dominating a particular sport for you?
Well, the last decade that the SEC has put together has been particularly spectacular when you consider kind of the heights that college football has risen to in general, with all the television revenue kind of being thrown into all these Power Five conference programs across the country. There's a lot of money involved in this, and a lot of people have a lot on the line, and wins and losses are the ultimate in what they're pursuing right now and who gets the biggest slice of that pie. So the fact that the SEC has been able to take it when it's mattered the most and there's been the most money on the line, that's certainly impressive there. Now, however, it's not exactly like the SEC has just been this 10-year flash in the pan. They've been, since about 1965 or so, which is, kind of, it's when desegregation started there in the Southeast. Since desegregation started, and it's no coincidence that these things have run concurrent, the SEC has been in that top one or two conversation, with the Big Ten kind of tapering off after World War II there into the 60s. They've been right there. They've either been right at number one with maybe the Southwest Conference giving them a bit of a challenge there in the late 70s, and then they were again probably the top conference in college football in the 80s into the 90s, where you get like this three-headed monster with the Pac-12, the Big Ten, and the SEC that were all just kind of neck and neck for the top conference. And then since about 2005, obviously the SEC's been the best conference in the country by a pretty considerable margin if you look at their kind of 10-year rolling strength. SB Nation had a really, really cool chart out looking at like rolling 10-year conference strengths by a statistic called the SRS stat that sportsreference.com has up. Like I said, the SEC has been pretty consistent at the top there for the last 40 to 50 years at this point. Now, at this point, given what we've seen over the course of the last couple of years, I think it's safe to say that the gap has been significantly margined, if not completely eliminated. Now, I'm still not comfortable in saying that there's a league in the country that's outright better than the SEC right now. I think there are some leagues that can certainly or certainly should be in the conversation, and it's not just a one-sided affair like it has been for the past decade. But I'm still not completely ready to say that the SEC has completely fallen off at this point, and I still think they're going to compete on a year-to-year basis. You look at what they did from a recruiting standpoint this year. I think they had 10 to 12 teams in the top 25 at 247 Sports' composite recruiting rankings, which is just remarkable. And if you continue to recruit at that kind of a level, it's difficult for other conferences to continue to compete with that type of talent.
Yeah, I mean, you can say that it might be annoying sometimes that you hear SEC fans saying they're by far the best football conference, but they might not have the knowledge and historical backing to back that up, but it is true to some degree. You know, they've been dominant for a long time. Maybe dominant is not the right word, but they've been one of the top conferences for a very long time. Another team that has been talked about a good bit recently, especially with these 30 for 30s by ESPN, is Miami. They've had some great runs in their past. And Ryan, you had a really good article today on Stage U, and actually I was wrong earlier. The Steve Spurrier one was Fanrag on Monday. The one today was Miami. Talking about Alec Bolden, sort of the culture at Miami, so definitely check that article out if you haven't read it. Do you think, Ryan, that Miami needs to return to sort of, it's not a darker sort of reputation, but it is sort of a lack of theme for the rules or how it's supposed to be done. Do you think there's something that needs to return to Miami for them to get back to the top, or can they sort of change their image and return to the Miami of old?
Well, I think given the general state of mind of that city, Miami's a very vibrant, very lively city. It's a city with a lot of excitement going on, a lot of cultural diversity, and I don't think that the city of Miami has ever had a team that kind of reflected the culture of that town quite as well as those national championship teams over the course of 1983 to 2001 ever have at Miami there. I mean, you know, they've had championships with the Dolphins, the Marlins, and the Heat, but I don't think they've ever really identified with a team quite the way that they have with those Miami Hurricane programs. And the one thing that all five of those national champions from 83 to 2001 have in common is they weren't just great football teams with a ton of talent on the roster. They had quite a bit of showmanship on the roster, too. If it wasn't from the top down with guys like Howard Schnellenberg and Jimmy Johnson, at the very least, it was rosters that had a bunch of folks who liked to have a lot of fun, played really, really good football, and just kind of had a lot of fun doing it. And, you know, it doesn't feel like they've had that same kind of energy, particularly in the Al Golden era. I think even during the Randy Shannon era with your Ja'Cory Harris's and players like that, there was still a little bit of that swagger that we expect from Miami. We haven't seen that from Al Golden. I think outside of the way Duke Johnson runs, and Duke Johnson's just he's an enigma. He's just an incredible football player, and I think you could put him on any field with anybody in the country, and he's going to do exciting things for your football team. But outside of that, there just hasn't been a lot of excitement from Al Golden's Miami, and that doesn't really work given the difficulties that you can have in that area from time to time. They have a new stadium, but they have difficulty drawing fans in because of, you know, the Florida sunshine and everything that there is going on outside of football there. If you don't have a product that's exciting to watch, it's difficult to draw fans. And Al Golden's football hasn't been particularly exciting to watch. You know, after 3 years of kind of slowly but surely building that program back up into a 9-3, 9-4 type team, they took a big step back this year going 6-7. With 11 starters back next year, they're probably going to be hurting quite a bit. And, you know, the ACC is getting quite a bit better. I think there's a lot more teams playing a lot more competitive football in the last 24 months than there was a couple of seasons ago. So it's going to be difficult for Miami to continue to compete. And I think at this point, it's not particularly off to say that Al Golden was, you know, the wrong hire for them. I think they need a coach with just a little bit more life, and whether that's a former Miami player, and there's a lot of great alumni there who have a ton of interest in, you know, that job and that city and that program, I think they can find a coach that can pump maybe a little bit more life into it.
Yeah, I mean, you made the point in the article that Miami is sort of known as being, you know, stylish and cool and very hip, and Al Golden might be the least stylish head coach in the country with his in terms of apparel. So, Dustin, do you think that Al Golden is the right guy for the job? Can he take them back to the top? He's kind of protected by this long contract. Do you see any way Miami finds a way to get out of that, or going to be Al Golden's potentially his last year in Miami?
Well, anytime you're not happy with the way a coach is performing, you can always find a way out of a contract. It's just a matter of how long you're willing to keep him around it and make the change. I don't know that Al Golden's the right guy for the job. but he was thrown into a difficult situation, and Miami's not a good place or a good fit for a lot of head coaches. I mean, I think you really have to dig and find somebody who really wants to be there. You know, I think of simple things that are really hurting right Miami right now. I mean, just the penalties that you'll see for celebration and you know, that sort of thing. And then you've got Big Brother watching over you with the NCAA, with your recruiting and that sort of thing, with all the different allegations and the Nevin Shapiro thing going on. So Miami has become a tough place. I mean, it's not comparable really to SMU, but you can draw some similarities there in just how, you know, they were dominant at one point, and now the effects of the NCAA and some of those allegations and some of the sanctions coming down are affecting them. I think I did see a few names that I saw were popular in college football if they were going to replace Al Golden, and that's Mario Cristobal, who is a former Miami guy, and he was named the 2015 Recruiter of the Year by Rivals.com. So that's a guy you can get in there and who might be able to recruit your city, your state, a little bit better than what Golden's been able to do. And then I also thought that, you know, a guy like Greg Schiano, who also has Miami ties, and he instilled the keep chopping trademark up at Rutgers as something, a little bit of an idea he got at Miami. But if you could get the city or the team to rally around, it doesn't have to necessarily be a catchphrase or something like that, but just some sort of tradition or bring something new, something that gets the community involved, the city of Miami involved with the program, I think that would be beneficial. So I don't know that I'll see Al Golden staying around much longer, but I think it's still going to be a hard fit for anybody, for any coach that's interested in that job, just because of what's happened here in the last 5-10 years.
Yeah, I definitely think there'd be a ton of interest in the job. I mean, it's definitely well ahead of him getting fired. Or you could say he's on the hot seat, but probably the beginning of the hot seat process. I would love to. With that being said, I mean, some of the names you could bring in, I mean, he has no head coaching experience, but it would just be awesome to have Warren Sapp, you know, just strolling the sideline for Miami, Ray Lewis as his D coordinator. I mean, you'd get recruits there in a heartbeat. They might not be able to play, you know, football on the field from an X's and O's standpoint, but you could have some fun with the coaching search there. We'll close things out with some quick takes on the NFL draft. I know they're doing a ton of coverage of the NFL draft over on Today's Pigskin, but seems like Marcus Mariota now is definitely going to the Eagles based on what Chip Kelly's doing there in Philadelphia, one way or another. He'll probably end up on the Eagles. Jameis Winston's the other big name. Will likely go at the top of the draft. Seems like everybody has him at one now. Ryan, do you think Jameis Winston can be successful in the NFL with sort of a similar playing style that we saw in his senior season, where he turned the ball over a ton of times, but when he had to make a play, he led his team to victory? You've seen that happen in the NFL before, guys like Brett Favre, who has a ton of turnovers, a guy like Ben Roethlisberger, who the stats might not jump off the stat sheet, but they find a way to win. Can he do that in the NFL where his turnovers are high, but he still gets wins, or is the NFL sort of going to catch up to him eventually?
Well, from a skill set standpoint, there's no doubt that Jameis Winston can be successful in the National Football League. He's got everything that you want in terms of the size and the arm and the fact that he played in a pro-style offense at Florida State. Now, I don't know that he's necessarily resigned to the fate of being a turnover machine. I know that's what we kind of saw out of him as a senior, but let's not forget that that's not quite as good of a football team that we saw in 2013 as what we saw in 2014 as what we saw in 2013. He didn't have a Kelvin Benjamin out there to constantly correct his mistakes, and they were inexperienced at wide receiver beyond Rashad Greene. And you know, I've read a couple of articles out there that have mentioned the amount of mishaps that they had at wide receiver that led to some of those mistakes that ultimately wind up, being given to Jameis Winston in the form of interception. So I don't know that that's necessarily the player that he is. We saw him protect the football pretty well as a junior. So I'd start by saying I don't think that he's necessarily a turnover machine. But if he does and he makes enough spectacular plays around it, he can certainly continue to carve out a pretty successful career for himself as a National Football League quarterback. I think his biggest issue is still just kind of going to be the off the field stuff and whether or not he can consistently put together game winning drives like he did as a junior and even again as a senior.
Yeah, he definitely has all the tools, so it'll be interesting to see how well he can develop and mature, not just on the field, but off the field, as you said. Dustin, if you were a bookie trying to get Ryan and I to bet on Jameis Winston's rookie year, over under on interceptions, what number would you give it?
Oh, boy.
That's a tough one on the side.
Yeah, and I have no betting background. I'm terrible. You've heard me make some ridiculous – I think Alex would grill me on this if he were on the podcast today. I'm going to say if he was to start in all 16 games, I'm going to say he's going to throw 14 interceptions.
That's not bad for a rookie season.
Like Ryan said, I think we've seen him in moments where he's protected the football and he appeared to be much better and much more comprehensive there in his 2013 campaign compared to the 2014 campaign. So, and it also depends on what system he's in. If he's with Tampa Bay, who's been in a world of mess over the past several years, I mean, he may throw a lot more interceptions as compared to, if he was in a different offense under a different coaching staff. But we'll see. I'm not going to rule the kid as a flop already, as he may be labeled, but he can win at the next level. It's just a matter of, I think, if he's in the right system in the right situation.
Yeah. I'm pulling for him. I hope he does well. I think he got a lot of crap in college and probably brought that on himself. But any time a guy's potentially going to be a number one pick, you want him to do well because you don't want him to be a flop. But thank you guys for joining the podcast today. You can read Ryan and Dustin a bunch of times a week on Today's You and find them on Twitter. Ryan is at Ryan_Wooden, and Dustin is at Sharp_Shooter. That's SHUTTER. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
You too.
Thanks, Colin.